chance for our two experts on this subject to really engage in a deep discussion, touching all the relevant points. When the case really has been unfolding literally over the last month, from the first time the accusations were revealed by the editors of by the paper in Haaretz, the newspaper journalists, the discussion, the work of the Beis Din of Rav Eliyahu, and of course the subsequent suicide of Chaim Walder, and then sadly the suicide right afterwards of one of his victims. And it's been a case that's really been overwhelming to process. And last Thursday, we decided that the Rabbinical Council of America wanted to give support to our chaverim, to other rabbanim in the field, trying to figure out how to lead their congregations, how to really deal with their own children. And we turned to Dr. Norman Blumenthal, the director of Trauma, Bereavement, and Crisis Intervention at OWL's Children, Home, and Family Services, for his expertise to really guide our rabbanim in this process. And in the context of doing that discussion, which was led by our own Rabbi Mark Dratch, the Executive Vice President of the Biblical Council of America, and someone who, I guess in a sad way, has the most experience really being involved in the forefront of dealing with sexual abuse in the Orthodox community for more than 25 years, it became clear there was a need to expand this program beyond the horizons of just the Rabbanim, just our Chaverim dealing with the issues in the field, but really open it up to the broader community, because it really is something that has been so powerful and overwhelming and so difficult indeed to process. And there are many, many questions that need to be addressed. What I'm going to do is start off with a more global question to Dr. Blumenthal, and really in many ways let he and Rabbi Dratch discuss this topic and the related issues that arise. And I'll periodically be chiming in with some questions to keep the discussion going. But really, there's so many facets that they're well aware of and well-versed and are important for us to share with our audience this evening. So let's start with the most basic question. Dr. Blumenthal, what has been the impact on the community?
Oh, boy. Okay. I love short questions. They require long answers. Hey, first of all, it's a great privilege to be on and to be representing just a wonderful organization, and humbling to be on the panel with both Rabbi Blau and Rabbi Dratch. From our respective garments, I guess it's pretty evident who are the rabbis and who's the mental health professional. In terms of this watershed event, you know, it sort of reminds me of a saying my mother, Leah Shalom, had. My mother was a Holocaust survivor with a treasure trove of Yiddish sayings. And one of them was that when a poor man has a hernia, there's a pimple on it, which meaning that when there's one thing wrong, that's bad enough. But when you have cumulative issues or challenges, they grow exponentially. They grow greater. And there's so many different pieces. This is so multi-layered that I think it impacts on us in numerous ways, and all of which are sort of overlapping circles. First of all, is the sexual abuse piece. And again, one of those painful reminders, and I know something that certainly Rabbi Dratch has been championing for a lot longer than many of us have, which is the necessity to be aware that this happens, and also the necessity to teach our children and to empower our children. I believe I did so the other night, referenced the brilliance of the chief of police and the Jerusalem chief of police, who introduced the concept of Chefetz Chashod, where it was literally impossible for Israeli policemen to know where every potential bomb is that has been deposited somewhere in the city. So he empowered the citizens, made them like the policemen. And that's what we have to do here too. We have to empower our children so that when something of the sort that is alleged to have happened to so many children, as it was over Chaim Walder, that they're empowered and they know this is wrong. This isn't right. So it brings
Dr.
up Blumenthal, that issue.
Please. Just to challenge, to push a little bit on that particular point, because you did share that the other day with the members of the RCA. And while that's very important, because unfortunately they're the ones who will be the victims in seclusion and nobody else will be aware of it, but that places a very heavy burden on children who may be 5 years old or 10 years old or 15 years old. It places a heavy burden on the victim, and it kind of lets us as the community a little bit off the hook, because after all, what can we do? So I think that while it's true that we have to educate our children and train them and talk to them and make it feel safe for them to come to us, or to come to a trusted adult who can be helpful, to place the burden on them to keep themselves safe or to catch a perpetrator is in many ways overwhelming and unfair.
Well, I'll you know, we have a term in psychology called reframing, which is where you take something and put it a different way. So let's take it and put it a different way. We're not putting the burden of capturing these people on children. We're empowering children. We're educating children that their body belongs to them, and that nobody has the right to encroach on their body. So we can look at it as we're not, you know, making them, maybe that's the metaphor with the police was difficult, but or it was maybe a difference, but we're empowering the children. And we're also, maybe we can be integrated, as I was, something I was thinking of saying as well, into what we have to do as well, which is we have to educate our children on a healthy and a Torah perspective on sexuality. What is the function and purpose of sexuality? Why did Hashem give us this incredibly enjoyable capacity? For what purpose? And I think if we educate our children the right way, and very differently than what they're maybe educated by movies and popular music, etc., how we look, we're not against sexuality, we're not against pleasure, we're not ascetics, but what function and role, and what function and role do these very special parts of our body have? That needs to be, that's also in a way a safety measure. It's a safety measure, perhaps, I hope, preventing developing people who would exploit children or would use or would channel their sexuality in such a direction, but also teach our children to have a healthy and a Torah attitude towards it, which they will benefit them in life and in marriage.
Let me ask you the message to children, and it's hard to generalize because children at different ages have different needs and different abilities to understand things, and the framing is different. But from the child's perspective, is this about sex or this is about assault?
It's about both. They're intertwined. Part of, as you so well know, part of what's so destabilizing about sexual abuse is that it plays with your mind. It doesn't play just with your body. It blurs the boundary between what's pleasurable and painful. For the victim, there is a good chance there's a pleasurable experience. Somebody physically assaults someone, there's nothing pleasurable about it for the victim. But here's an assault on in a manner and fashion that they can potentially enjoy in some way, and along with feeling assaulted and hurt and harmed terribly. But also the predator often, especially someone as gifted and talented as this Chaim Wolder seems to be, can play with your mind and make you feel like you wanted this. So it's an assault on your body, it's an assault on your psyche. And that's what's so terrible, and it's so terribly confusing and destabilizing. If there is a healthy understanding why we have these parts of our body that are so potentially pleasurable, it'll be more instinctively understood that something wrong is happening here. And certainly we know from research that a sexual assault that is immediately reported and immediately stopped has nowhere nearly the pernicious effect as those where it's ongoing and where it has a semblance of a relationship.
What do parents need to do in order to make it possible for their children to report to them?
Okay, so I think we have to, first of all, most schools today, and certainly I have to say in the community that we're representing here, do have safety programs and do involve the parents. So reinforce the messages, and reinforcing the messages means not every day and constantly, because that just traumatizes a child, but at appointed moments. And that's the other thing that's important in terms of what you mentioned, because children have a capacity to learn messages about what's something that's dangerous and not let it dominate their thinking and have a perception of a dangerous world. And we have no better proof of that than something we've been doing now for well over 100 years, which is fire drills. Fire drills, I believe, began, I don't have my statistics for anything, but I think there was a terrible fire about 100 years ago in a school in Chicago, I believe it was a Catholic school, which did not have fire safety and where exits were blocked, and the death was devastating. Again, I don't remember the exact numbers, but between teachers and students, it was devastating. And since then, it's become increasing the practice to mandate fire drills. So all of us went through fire drills since we're children, and yet we're not sitting in class all day thinking about the school burning down. And I think we can also give messages like that to our children. Unfortunately, today we have to do it about lockdowns. Lockdown drills are active shooters. And we can give those messages to our children. They store it away. They can mobilize it immediately if they have to, but they don't have to think about it constantly. And that's, I think, also a consideration as we educate our children. not only should they have a healthy enough attitude about or an understanding about sexuality that they will know immediately that this isn't right and do something about it, but also if in terms of the danger that they have those messages stored away and they can be carefree, happy, playful children, but God forbid if something like this happens, know immediately and know how to respond.
Right. I think that that's a very important message. And it also answers another challenge we hear sometimes from parents and from others in the community, that they want our children to remain pure somehow, and that somehow not talking about sex or not talking about abuse will protect them from being tainted by that outside world. And in fact, it seems to be that the opposite is true, that mm-hmm. by not sharing this information with them at age-appropriate levels in ways that they can understand and that can empower them, we're actually setting them up to be victims and to become corrupted, and their souls to become corrupted by not giving them the power, the tools that they need.
Sure. We also have, and you know this better than I do, Rabbanim, we have a long-standing tradition about not talking about sexuality. You know, the Gemara says only the shaita, only the fool talks about it. And for many, many generations, we treat this aspect of, let's say, marriage as something kadosh, something holy, not something you banter about, not something you make jokes about. It's a very sacred, holy connection between couples. So we don't banty it about and discuss it, but those were in times when the world was also had more discretion and at least publicly more modesty and restraint. Today we live in a time where there's very little restraint and everything is so blunt and out there, and therefore we don't have that luxury anymore.
But it also means that we as a community need to feel comfortable talking about it in appropriate ways and to make it part of the conversation. As you mentioned before, I spent many years dealing with issues of fighting sexual abuse and domestic violence and clergy abuse. And these were discussions around my Shabbos table, and these were discussions in my family. And my kids at relatively young ages were hearing this and absorbing mm-hmm. it. But as a result, it wasn't something that was sensational for them. It was something right. that was just part of conversation, and therefore they were comfortable hearing about it, talking about it, challenging their friends when they felt their friends were speaking inappropriately about different issues. And so maybe it's parents, grandparents, adults, teachers that need to work on becoming comfortable sure. having a conversation and not overreacting. And
sure.
a parent,
I think, I think we need a curriculum. I think we need a curriculum for our schools. Throughout their education in the teachable moments. Sometimes I reference, you know, you have a second grader learning Parshas Noach, and he learns the Rashi that Noach was erred in planting grapes the first thing he came out of the Teva. And it's a good opportunity to say to young children, even before we would talk explicitly about sexuality, that we're not against pleasure. We're not against drinking wine. It's not the first thing you do. First thing you plant a vineyard, first you build a shul, a base medrash, you know, then you plant a vineyard. We're not against it. But there are many ways. Again, I'm not an educator, so I couldn't do that. But I think if educators and rabbanim and mental health professionals got together, well, I think we could develop a curriculum where this could be accomplished.
So I just want to mention that I have many roles, and I also work in a school, the Rosh Hashiva, the Fuchs Mizrahi School, and we do have a curriculum, Yocheved Debow. One of our educators, Meir Eliyahu, put together, and we've used for times. And I think there are materials out there. And I do want to encourage anyone listening to indeed follow up on that idea and make sure that there is the appropriate methods and educational tools in their schools to deal with a lot of these issues. I want to follow up on a Minyan Bo, so Minyan related matter. There's always that challenge when we're trying to encourage that parent, and of course, children have great respect for their Rabbanim, great respect for their teachers, great respect to those individuals, and yet at the same time, this level of awareness that perhaps not everyone deserves that respect. And how do you balance those two things accordingly? How do you make that bifurcation mm-hmm. in one's mind?
So first of all, it's important to keep in mind then the age of the child. That's a lot easier with adolescents than it is with pre-adolescent children, with elementary school age children. Because as I'm sure you know, as a machanach, that adolescents develop operational thinking. They can understand the concept that there can be many different sides to people. That people can be can sort of compartmentalize and the many different parts to them. So the notion that somebody could look very holy and act very holy and just about every aspect of life, and then one can behave in such a reprehensible way, and it could be the same person, is easier message to adolescents than it is to younger children who see things in more sort of polarized or two-dimensional ways, just because of the nature of their brain and their thinking. So with very young children, that's a very hard message to say, we want you to show this, you know, this reverence and respect for people who look, dress, and sort of are your educators a certain way. But then if they engage in this behavior, then they're suddenly, they're criminals. It's very hard. Sometimes when I speak to educators, I think a wonderful opportunity is the famous Rashi in Lech Lecha, when Avram says to Lot, where they have to separate. And Rashi says that Lot and Avram looked alike, but Lot let his goats into other people's fields, so people thought Avram was doing it. And so therefore they have to separate. And it's an opportunity to say to kids, you know, you can look like an Avram Avinu and still be a Ganav. It's a hard message for young children, but it's unfortunately a message we have to give, that people are judged by what they do, not how they look.
Right. I mean, the Gemara speaks about this explicitly when it speaks about a certain Talmid Chacham who was engaged in illicit behavior, and they didn't know what to do with him, because on the one hand, the Gemara says we need him. He's successful. He's charismatic. He's being, you know, he's teaching. He's inspiring all of these people. And on the other hand, he's engaged in very, very inappropriate behavior. So eventually, Rabbi Yochanan is quoted. The pasuk says in Malachi, ki siftei kohen yishmeru dat v'tari yavakshu mipihu, ki malach Hashem tzivakotu, that you will seek Torah from the lips of the kohen, because he is a malach Hashem tzivakot, a messenger of God. The Gemara, Rabbi Yochanan then says, only if the Rav is Doma Lamalach Hashem Tzivakot, only if he's angelic, should you learn from him. If he's not, then you should not learn from him. Truth is that Gemara itself is problematic, because to assume that the Rav is a Malach, is an angel, is more than human, can create problems as well. But essentially what it is teaching us is that if a person does not live what he preaches, and he doesn't reflect, or she doesn't reflect the great values of what Torah and decency are supposed to be, then that person is not to be studied from, and that person is not to be respected. Now, how we teach that to younger children without undermining a sense of reverence is very, very difficult. But it becomes a very, very important lesson.
Oh, sure. Mm-hmm.
The next point I want to raise is really, in a certain sense, and we touched upon this earlier, I think, Dr. Blumenthal, going back to your Chafetz Chashud, the Chafetz Chashud is something that the whole community has to be aware of. So in a certain sense, what a number of questions. When the issues arise, what is the right direction? And in Israel, they went to Rav Eliyahu's Beis Din. Why was that? Was that the best place to go? Was that the best place to go under the circumstances in Israel, in a given community? And I'm assuming many of the people watching this evening are actually in the United States. So what is the first response? What is the healthiest response? Where do we take our concerns?
Maybe it's a little out of my turf. Maybe actually Roy Drach would be a better person to answer that. And I certainly can't speak about Israel in terms of, I actually had a guest this morning from Eretz Israel, a rabbi from Eretz Israel, who was talking about and was saying that sometimes the police are not so responsive in Israel. So I don't know if he was just his own bias or if it's really true. I think what we go to is law enforcement. We don't take care of it ourselves. We have the shoftim, we don't have the shotrim, here in the States at least. And we have to rely on law enforcement. And we live in a country, I believe, that believes in justice and will follow through on criminal acts. So that's my understanding. Rabbi, maybe you have more experience with that than I do.
No, 100%, because if the perpetrator, who was a rodef, who was really halachically as a pursuer, needs to be stopped. Certainly the rabbis, non-judicial, non-law enforcement agencies have no jurisdiction and no power and no way to control that. The challenge is that many victims are very much afraid to go to the police and will not go to the police, either because they're afraid of the consequences. In certain parts of the Orthodox community, they're afraid of being ostracized or future shiduchim, marriage prospects, for them or their or the extended family, maybe they're not psychologically strong enough and healthy enough to do that. And they may not have a good place to turn. Now, there are many people in the United States, professionals who work with children, that are mandated reporters. So if somebody comes to such a professional, that person is obligated by law to make a report to the proper authorities. But there's a challenge, because if people know that and they don't want to go for help, then the children, the victims themselves are struggling, and the perpetrator is running free. That's why in Israel, for example, an organization like the Takana Forum, which serves more of the Dati Leumi community, was created for a place for people to go to speak to rabbis, to speak to professionals outside of law enforcement. And those who organized it felt it was better than nothing. It's not legal in this country to do something like that. And we need to, you know, talking about the culture of the community that needs to change, we need to create an environment in which it is okay to make a report, in which there's no stigma that's attached to making such a report, in which there are no consequences to families and in the community or to communities when a report is made. And we're doing better than we were doing 30 years ago when I got involved in this. But I think that we still have a long way to go with this.
I would add 2 points also in terms of the reluctance of the victim to report it. First of all, again, as I said, there's mind games that are going on. So the victim very often feels like a participant, not necessarily a victim. Again, that's the sort of brainwashing that accompanies this. But also, it's interesting that when something terrible like that happens to you, there's a brain shutdown, which in a way is adaptive, because if you're being assaulted, if you're less cognizant of it, it doesn't hurt as much. But because there's a sort of cognitive shutdown, sometimes the capacity to recapture the events, especially with the very detailed interrogation that law enforcement is going to do, you don't have available. So there's like a fog. This was very, very dramatically portrayed during the Sandusky trial, where one of his victims was on the stand and he described how when he was being actively abused, how he sort of like didn't know what was going on, like he got confused. And but again, when you have to reconstruct those events, and sufficiently so that you can press charges, that can be very complicated.
Yeah, there's a lot of work that's being done in terms of training for cultural competence with law enforcement, with child protective agencies, which becomes very important. People are afraid. They don't know about Orthodox Jews. What's going to happen to our family? They're going to take somebody away right away and put them in a non-kosher or non-Shomer Shabbos type of environment. Those types of things generally do not happen. And while the investigation can be disruptive, it's certainly not easy. It's not as dire as people may fear. The other important point that I think we have to remember is that when a child comes to share information with a parent or with a teacher or with a trusted friend, our first response is extremely important. If we express shock, or even worse, if we express disbelief, that no, it couldn't be that person doing such a thing, we will shut down this victim from looking for help in the future.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely.
So on the related matter, I think you've already touched upon it, but what does it mean to stand up for the victims? And what are we doing as a community? What should we be doing as a community to create that type of environment that people feel comfort if something amiss is occurring to really report it? How do we stand up for them?
Rabbi, you?
Okay, well, let me suggest a few things, and then there's probably much more that we can do. First of all, we need to talk about it. When I was doing much more involved with my anti-abuse work, I once spoke to a board of rabbis and training them in issues of domestic violence. I said, one of the things that we need to do is talk about it publicly, to take away the stigma and to let people know that this is a Jewish issue, because there were many Jewish women who were victims of domestic violence who swore to me that they were the only, it couldn't be abuse because Jewish women are not abused, or they were the only ones that were being abused. So we need to take away the stigma by talking about it, whether it's for like we're having this evening, whether it's appropriate discussions around our Shabbos table or at other other occasions, whether it's shiurim or lectures in the synagogue, whether it's a rabbi mentioning the issue from the pulpit when he's delivering a sermon. As uncomfortable as it may be, we take away that discomfort and we empower people because we make it part of the public discussion. After I finished this training for the rabbis, I got a call 2 weeks later from one of the rabbis who was present. He said, you know, I never had a case of domestic violence in my community until the first time I talked about it. And it wasn't that he gave the husband an idea, but it was he gave a signal to a victim that he was somebody that was safe to talk to, and this was a conversation that could be had. So I think that's number one. Number two, I think we have to be careful how we talk about perpetrators. I think we did a tremendous disservice to the victims of Chaim Wilder when it came to the articles in the newspapers that referred to him as Zichrono Livracha or Zecher Tzadik Livracha, when thousands of people came to his funeral, when hespedim, when eulogies that were given by prominent rabbis lauded him for the contributions that he made. We have discredited and undermined the sense of victimization of right and wrong felt by the victims by doing that. So I think that's a second way in which we can do it. Dr. Blumenthal mentioned before curricula in schools, so that we talk about there are children sitting in our classrooms and there are people sitting in our shuls on Shabbos morning who themselves have been or are victims of sexual abuse. We have to assume that, and it's going to be true in not just 99% of the cases, but 100% of the cases. So we need to be careful how we talk about it. We can't speak about victims as being the other. We have to speak about victims and as part of us, because they are us. And whether it's us as individuals or as members of our family or our neighbors or the person sitting next to us. So we have to be very careful not to other and make a stranger out of victims. But we need to talk about it as all of our problem. And we need to support organizations and make them available and make funds available so that people can get the kind of help that they need.
Yeah, it's a little I can add, but I do think it's very, it's a trick. I'm going to say it's like a paradox that if you know a victim, you know someone who has, and it could be from childhood, it could be many years ago, to validate their pain. It's very important. And hopefully most people in the audience don't know what that pain is like, but it is terribly painful and destabilizing. And sometimes the best we can do is just recognize to the extent that we can, that we accept, recognize. I know my friend and colleague David Pelkovitz likes to point out that the word in Hebrew, ashrei, for happiness, is also ishur, confirmation, validation. And validation does help. On the other hand, though, we have to also recognize that everybody's experience is unique. And certainly if you haven't had that experience, which I hope is true of most of us, that's very hard to connect and relate to it. So don't neither give them impression like you know exactly what they're going through. It's a validating the trauma that they've been through, and at the same time acknowledging that it's not one that we can fully understand.
So in light of that point, in many of these instances, we find situations where people remember things from many years ago. And the question is, I guess from a psychological standpoint, and both, I guess, Rabbi Dratch dealing with this experientially, why does this happen this way? How does that work? How do they process it that it takes so long sometimes? Is it repressed? What's really going on in those circumstances?
So I think, as I indicated earlier, part of what, you know, anyone will tell you that a pain on your body is easier to handle than a pain in your heart. And a physical assault is easier than an assault on your brain, on your psyche. And sexual abuse is not only an assault on your body and a horrible assault on your body. And by the way, it's a terrible betrayal also, as you know, that majority of predators or of people who prey on children are known to the child, and a significant number are family members. And when protective figures, people are supposed to be protective figures, turn around and instead of protecting the child, exploit the child for their pleasure, it's hard to imagine a greater betrayal than that, and that's something they have to live with. There was a book written by, I forgot, it's called Queen for the Day, I think. It's written by Marilyn Van Derber, who was Miss America in 1958, which, of course, you and Rabbi Dach and I, we can remember that, right? From 1958, right? No, but anyway, but we do know that in 1958, being Miss America was not what it is like to be Miss America in 2022. It was really quite a accomplishment. And she was abused terribly by her father and her sister. And she wrote a book about it. And there's this line in there that I often think about when I'm working with abuse victims, is that, and she says at one point, we can't put them in jail, so we put ourselves in jail. And that's very much what the victim lives with. So it is one of, I mean, if you see the research on events that have lasting traumatic residual effects, and sexual abuse, especially the recurrent sexual abuse, is up there with witnessing murder of your parents and warfare and things of that sort. It's really one of the worst things that can happen to someone, and we have to acknowledge that.
Yeah, I would just add that, as we mentioned before, when if a child does not feel that he or she is going to be believed, they're not going to come forward.
Right.
And then they're going to create this mindset that nobody will ever believe them, and that they have no power to hold to protect themselves, or no power to hold the perpetrator accountable. And therefore, they're going to silence themselves, which is why I think when, for example, the whole Me Too movement started, or when a situation like the Walder case comes about, and you know, it becomes a trigger for a lot of people. But if they see the community responding appropriately, this empowers them to feel safe to come forward.
So I want to answer the question that I think sometimes we're always concerned about a term being used inappropriately. We know there is the concept of speaking Lashon Hara, and the fact that you're not really supposed to be, you know, inappropriate about others. And that relies to the challenge, because on the one hand, we want to talk about the perpetrators. On the other hand, you know, a lot of us not mention other particular details of the case, and without asking you to paskin necessarily, although Rabbi Dach, it is within your purview, and Dr. Blumenthal may feel that's beyond. But what are the guidelines here? You know, when do we have...
I was only crazy enough to become a psychologist, not a rabbi.
Okay, but it's a legitimate question, because it doesn't mean that not everything that's brought up, every rumor that we heard, are we allowed to repeat. So, you know, what would you think, but from a psychological standpoint, in terms of where there's circumstances where there's more, I mean, the term we often use is reglaim ledavar, what would the guidelines be? What would be appropriate and what would be necessary? Rabbi Dach, I think right. You perhaps would take this one first.
I remember when my son was rather young, he came... We were having a conversation one day, and he started to say something about a friend of his in school. He says, oh, no, I can't say anything. It's Lashon Hara. And at first, I was very proud. Oh, you know, my tuition dollars are paying off, and my son is paying attention and being inspired, and this is a wonderful thing. And then I got very angry, because this was really something he needed to share with me because of some bullying that was taking place. And that, in fact, there was not only was there no prohibition of Lashon Hara there, it was an obligation. It was an obligation to speak. It was an obligation to speak in therapy about everything. It's the Chafetz Chaim quotes the pasuk, you know, when you share the things in your heart, there's a benefit. There's a healing part to it, which is very, very important. But sharing something for which there is a toelet, for which there is a positive benefit, whether it's for one's own safety, and certainly when it's for the safety of the public, not only is there no prohibition of speaking, but there's an obligation to speak out. The Nitziv, in his commentary on Chumash and the Hamek Davar, points out the important juxtaposition of the two clauses in the verse in Vayikra, which speak about Lashon Hara. Lo telech rachil ba'amecha, v'lo ta'amod al dam re'echa, ani Hashem. You shouldn't walk about as a talebearer. You shouldn't stand on your neighbor's blood. I am God. So we usually, most people understand that to mean don't walk around as a talebearer, as speaking Lashon Hara, because that is tantamount to spilling the blood of your neighbor. But the Nitziv says you can read it a second way as well, equally as important. And that is don't walk about as a talebearer, but don't stand on your neighbor's blood. Which means this is a tool to be able to save and protect people. So if it's just wanton gossip where there's no need to know and it's only some kind of purient interest, then there'd be a prohibition of Lashon Hara. But where there is a kol d'lo pasuk, where there are rumors that are going around and there are raglayim ledavar, there's good reason to believe that this is true. And as a result of sharing the information, will either bring a perpetrator to justice and or help protect people from possible harm, then there's not only is there no prohibition, there's an obligation to speak out.
I appreciate that. We've been going for close to 40 minutes. I know it's a little bit, the hour is late. So I want to make a number of observations and ask one final question for both of you to answer.
I just wanted to add one thing before you do that. I'm sorry, because it hit me. Is it one of the ways in which we can support, we can support victims? And specifically in this case, one of the most important ways I think that we can support victims is by removing Chaim Walder's books from your bookshelves. Number one is teaching a lesson to our children that we don't learn from people who behave in this manner. That goes back to the Gemara that I quoted before. A person is not like a malach Hashem Tzivakot. If a person's reputation, if a person's moral standing is questionable, is not a good teacher, no matter how inspiring or interesting the stories may be. That's number one. Number two is you don't know who's walking through your doors, who may be a guest at your Shabbos table, who may be your friends who themselves are victims of, whether it was a victim of Walder or a victim of anybody, and sees those books on the shelves,
right. And that's
a trigger for them. And it not only does it not support the victim, but it can re-victimize them.
Thank you, Rabbi Tretcher. That's a very, very important part. Sadly, I don't think this will be the only time the Rabbinical Council of America will have to do a program on this topic. There's so many related aspects that we didn't cover this evening. In the future, we'll have we have two distinguished individuals this evening. I'm sure there'll be other people we'll have on the panelists who have a different level of expertise. Again, there's the reality. You wish you don't have to talk about the subject, but part of what we discussed all evening is that we do ourselves a disservice and we do ultimately the victim a disservice if we don't talk about that which needs to be talked about. And of course, we'll keep people informed in the future. The last question really is such an obvious question, but it's about, again, as Dr. Blumenthal, one of my short questions that may have a longer answer is, what's the most important? The most important takeaway we should have as we move forward from what we've this entire episode. What's the most important thing that you'd like to either take away or you want to really transmit to the community, the people who are watching, the people who'll be watching this in the future, because it's being to be available to others. What's the most important lesson you think people should take away?
I hate to challenge the question,
okay,
but I think there are certain life experiences, especially people who are suffering, that they don't lend themselves to quantitative comparisons. And I'd be hard pressed. There's a lot we didn't get to touch on, but is it the sexual abuse? Is it the suicide? Is it the mental health component? Is it how we educate our children? How do we explain to our children some like Chaim Walder, which again falls more in your rubric, Rabbi Blau, as an educator? I have another issue, which now I hear other people starting to bring up, which is, you know, how do we look at, or how do we deal with the, what I call the Pied Pipers? Those charismatic individuals like Chaim Walder, who just, you know, what sometimes function as division heads in camp or as that inspiring rabbi in a girls' school or a seminary, the vast majority of whom I assume are using their talent in the right way. But is there a sort of like a rare but serious risk with some of these charismatic individuals, and how do we approach that? I mean, I'm struggling with this. I don't know the answer, but I think these are, and the books, I'm glad that Rabbi Drash brought that up, because I know people are really struggling with that. And, you know, do we, you know, if the content is good, what difference does it make of the person who wrote it? And by the way, I'm hearing more and more from people now that people are rereading the books and are seeing things that they overlooked that were frightening, that might have been clues. Now, because it's always 20/20 hindsight, but maybe it's impossible for a person with those kinds of reprehensible tendencies to really write a book that's positive and inspiring. These are questions I think we're going to be grappling with for a while. Which is most important? I don't think my shoulders are broad enough to say.
Dr. Mumov, I thank you for your answer, because the question was, it was not correct. There are many, many things, and I thank you for enumerating them. Rabbi Drash, I'll give you the last opportunity before we close.
I would say that it's a question of love, of loving our children, loving them enough to protect them and do what is right for them, and not because of from our own sense of shame or our own inconvenience or our own embarrassment, run away from that. To love them enough to do and to teach them and to set up a home and a school and a shul and a community that is safe for them and that will respond to them if they're in trouble. And I think we have to love our community enough to be willing to have difficult conversations like this. I would hear very often over the years, you know, why are you talking about this publicly? You're airing our dirty laundry. What kind of reputation are you giving? We be giving the Orthodox community if you talk about abuse in our community? And my answer always was that the Chil Hashem, the desecration of God's name, the shame of it, it's not the fact that we had the issue. The real shame is that we didn't respond to the issues and the perpetrators and to our children in the proper way. Unfortunately, it's always going to be here. It's what we do and the structures that we put into place and the way we teach halacha that is a way of that elevates the community and elevates its safety and champions the victims and the underdog and the weak and the vulnerable. That, I think, is the most important. So I think we have to love our children more. I think we have to love our community more. And we have to love ourselves more.
Thank you both, Dr. Blumenthal and Rabbi Dratch, for your participation this evening. I think we need the courage of our convictions to build the communities, the healthy communities. And let's continue to do so. Let's continue to fight that valiant fight. And Amir Tashem, we can protect those who need their protection. I thank you all for this evening.
Okay. Thanks for the opportunity.
Thank you very much. And thank you, Rabbi Blau.